Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. My name's Claire Reynolds, and I'll be speaking with Dr. Kutcha Risling Baldy. Dr. Baldy is a writer, blogger, and educator. She's Hoopa, Yurok, and Karuk, and is an enrolled member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe in Northern California. Dr. Baldy is also a professor of Native American Studies at Humboldt State University and has just published her first book, We Are Dancing for You, Native Feminisms and the Revitalization of Women's Coming-of-Age Ceremonies.
You know, I think the work that's been done for a number of years to talk about feminism and the importance of equality for all genders really has left out a conversation about how gender equality and the way that we understand gender has always been a conversation that has happened in Native communities. And the goals of Native feminisms are to sort of highlight that Native peoples come from like a very long tradition of Native feminism, that they value the equality of all genders, that they were having conversations about the importance of equality in their cultures and societies, and that colonialism really targeted those types of practices for eradication. And so Native feminisms is sort of saying we can't have a conversation about feminism without having a conversation about the impact of colonialism, and that the goals of what feminism needs to be working toward need to help support the ongoing sovereignty and self-determination of Native nations. There's all kinds of examples of Native nations throughout the Americas where they would bring women to treaty negotiations. They would bring women and they would refuse to talk to the women. And you have lots of indigenous nations that had women's councils, or they had women who were the ultimate decision makers about if the nation was going to go to war, if they were going to make a treaty. And those kinds of practices were really targeted by colonialism because they did not want women to be in charge. You can see a direct link between the way that they viewed Native women during sort of like the missions and the gold rush and this whole period of time where they're trying to sort of like get rid of Native people and they're trying to genocide and annihilate them. Native women are in very particular types of incidences. They're not just viewed as wanting them to just all disappear or be dead. Most of them actually get sold into slavery. And so you're looking at the records and you see that there's a large slavery institution that comes up in California during the gold rush. And most of the time when you look at headlines, it'll say something like all the men were killed and the women and children were taken. And they don't really elaborate on what taken is. But really what that means is most of the time for women, that meant that they were sold to someone as a concubine, as a slave. They were sold to prostitution rings. And so it was really like women are treated in this way. And that's not to say men are treated better just because most of the time that just meant that they were killed. Like the men are the threats to them. And when you look at the actual records in Humboldt County, which is really interesting, because sometimes when people think about the slave trade, they'll think that, you know, people are going in and mostly getting adults because they need workers. If you look at the records in Humboldt County, it's actually mostly children, ages like 7 to 12, and it's mostly young girls who are being traded into slavery. And that's not something that a lot of people think about, that when we're talking about this system of slavery, I mean, it's really pretty obvious that what we're talking about is like a system of sex slavery. And so it becomes dangerous for us as Native people to elevate and celebrate our women the way that we had. Because if we take women as leaders, they will kidnap those women. If we take women to the table to have discussions, they will go after those women. And then we have this dance, this ceremony that we do for young women when they come of age, which is usually when they start menstruating. And it becomes dangerous to do that dance because people would know that we were celebrating this girl, and they would show up, minors would show up to kidnap that girl or to take that girl. Really? Because they're in a vulnerable position of being in ceremony, not in a space where they can sort of like, you know, be defended. And there's plenty of old stories about minors spreading rumors that what we were doing in this dance is advertising that the girl was a woman so she could go off and be taken. And so they would show up and say, see, this is what you guys are doing. You're like advertising her. So they totally misconstrued what was going on so that they could justify these actions. And so when, after a long time of, I mean, after a period of time of that, we as a people had to make a decision about what we were going to do, because our young girls are really vulnerable. And the dance kind of goes underground. You don't see it as much. You don't hear about it. You have a lot of people that won't do it. But in reality, we were faced with these very tough decisions about what it would mean to put our girls out there and the way that people were using that as to be able to target them.
I mean, I don't know if you can answer this or you want to answer this, but like, where does that type of brutality towards another human being come from?
Jack Forbes, he's like a really prolific Native scholar. He actually talks about it as like a psychosis. It's very like endemic to how people grow up and learn that somehow the exploitation of things is the most important. And so we have like the value of extracting resources, the mm-hmm. value of exploiting everything so that you can get the most of it, like out of it for yourself. What I think is important to remind people, like when we talk about the gold rush, especially in Humboldt County and what happened to Native people here, is that, you know, the perpetuation of the violence against Native people in this area was legalized by the state of California, and it was supported by the federal government. And so when we're talking today, when we have contemporary issues today about what's legal and not legal, or who's legal and not legal, we have to keep in mind that it was legal at that time to kill Indian people. It was legal at that time to kidnap Indian children. It was legal to sell children into slavery. And so when you're talking about people learning that somehow the law is always just, versus how do you start having conversations about what this really means for people? And students ask me all the time, you know, how could this be going on and nobody's freaking out? Like, we know that they're killing hundreds of thousands of people. We know that they're turning in like scalps and heads for money. Like, we know those things. It's in the newspaper. Why aren't people freaking out? And I say to them, you know, it's easy to think that you would be the person that says the thing the loudest, but we have things that are going on in our own country today where people are being dehumanized and tortured and hurt. It's happening. Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of remember that those things are always going on, and that it is up to us to sort of learn about that so we can have these conversations about what's happening in our contemporary times.
In these contemporary times, the coming of age ceremonies have come back into regular practice in the last 30, 40 years or mm-hmm. so. What does coming of age for a young woman mean to you?
I think a lot of it is about having conversations and acknowledging that this is a period of time in which people are physically experiencing a change in their bodies, but also that society itself is going to start treating them very differently. Mm-hmm. The things that we know about adolescence are that during adolescence, a young girl's self-esteem plummets. And this is sort of like across everywhere, not just for Native girls, just everybody. But a boy stays the same or increases. I mean, when you think about what adolescence is for young women, that's really around like menstruation and the changing of their bodies and who they are. And then the way that we talk about womanhood and what it means to be a woman. And so we have a job then to decide the experience that we want young women to have in adolescence. I think it makes a big difference to tell a young woman when she is coming of age that she's powerful, and instead of saying that there's something that she needs to hide or feel shameful about. And we have a whole, I mean, we have a whole industry set up to shame us for being menstruators. And to make us feel like somehow we're supposed to pretend like it's not happening. Yeah. And that if somebody finds out, that's like the most embarrassing thing ever. I always use the example of like how many people, when they have a tampon that they need to go use in a bathroom, they like push it up their sleeve, or they right. put it in their pocket, or they hide it between their hands when they're walking, because like, heaven forbid anybody see you walking to the bathroom with a tampon in your hand.
Can you describe the cover of your book and tell us a little bit about the significance of the different things that the woman is wearing on the cover?
Yeah, so the cover is actually based off a photo of I took of a young woman. In it, she's wearing the blue jay veil, which is what the young woman wears when she's in the ceremony. And they're actually there are blue jay veils throughout different tribes here in the Northwest that they use during women's ceremonies. And in Hoopa, what they talk about is it helps the girl to remain in meditation because she has to, in different periods of time, run through the valley. And people can see her while she's running. And so it shields her from the people that are looking at her. It reminds her to stay in a certain space. It also helps to let people know that she's in this period of time with her ceremony. So if they can like not look directly at her or turn away, because that helps her to remain in meditation. And it really, I think, what the girls talked about with me, because I actually interviewed a lot of them to talk about what was going on, and they really said that it was a reminder for them to think about their next step and not to just be looking way forward or way back, or to think about how much further they had to go, because they have to run every single day of the ceremony. And they said, you know, instead of looking all the way down the path, like, I have so much further to go and how am I going to make it? The veil makes me look right here in the right now. Wow. And I can only see what's right in front of me. And so then I can keep going until I get to the point that I need to get to. So I think it teaches them a lot about the decision-making process. Like what the old ones, they said that the old ones said, like, how she runs is how she's going to live her life. And so you help her to be able to live her life in a good way. And she gets to make these decisions. If she trips, they tell her she should go back and run that same part again. If she gets tired, she can slow down if she wants to go faster. But this is about her saying, who do I want to be? And I have the strength and the fortitude to be able to make these decisions for myself. So all those kinds of things are happening in this ceremony for her.
Well, that's a really powerful experience.
And most, it's funny how many of the young women were like, I was kind of afraid of the run. But then when they did it, they were like, it was a really amazing experience. And it allowed me to see that I could do it, that I could do anything. And they all talk about how they took that with them. It was like, well, you know, I need to do this next thing. Well, I know I can do it because I did these other things. So, and I think that our elder women and our medicine people are really good at being like, you know, you need to set your pace. Like, don't let other people tell you to go faster. Don't tell yourself I'm not doing this good enough. Like, you decide for yourself who you're going to be and how you're going to run. And I think that starts at the age of like, you know, 11, 12, 13, telling them that they have the power to be able to make the decisions for themselves about the kind of person they want to be. And that they can do these like tasks that feel large and impossible in like small ways that get them through lives.
Your book, We Dance For You, addresses gender inequality and gender violence within the Native communities. What are the points that you really want to make to the readers about gender inequality and gender violence and how things can be safer for all genders?
Well, I think that when you look at the statistics of what Native people are facing, it can become as a Native person very overwhelming. We are the most likely to be victims of sexual assault of any group in the United States. We are less than 2% of the population, but as Native women are most likely to be sexually assaulted, most likely to be victims of domestic violence, most likely to be victims of violence in general. We have youth who are the most likely to commit suicide. We have youth who are the most likely to attempt suicide. So it can sometimes be very disheartening when you are looking at statistics and when you look at like most likely to go to college. We're not in that statistic, but we are always in the one that's like most likely to be murdered. And that can be disempowering, and it can make it feel like, well, what could we ever do if that's just what we're facing? But I think that what I have learned in doing this kind of work is that we have, as Native people, always had ways in which we wanted to remind people that we are valued and that we are centered and that there is something very powerful about our ceremonies and our culture. and that power has been philosophized and built for a very, very long time. And so we're not talking, I mean, I always tell people, like, I'm not talking about we guessed and made it up. I'm saying minimum in California, we had like 10,000 years of figuring out what we needed to do to help young people. That's a lot of like experimentation and discussion and adaptation. So we're talking about all of that to be able to say, this is what young people need so that they can be the strongest that they can be, facing the world that they are going to face. So we're very lucky in that way to have that kind of knowledge. To reclaim it, I think, has taken a little while because, again, of all of these things that are coming up. When it comes to gender violence, we know that you can, like, a lot of the times people will think that it's native-on-native violence, but the statistics show that it's actually most likely non-native-on-native violence. So women are most likely to be sexually assaulted by non-native people, not by native people. So you're actually looking at a continuation of the ideologies of colonization and conquest that infests what happens to Native women today. So we are viewed in very particular ways. We are dehumanized. If you look at us, our representation in the media, you know, we are all often very sexualized. We still have the term squaw hanging out there. To this day, it's a derogatory term for Native women. It literally refers to them as like a body part only. I think that we're facing a lot when it comes to the violence that Native women face, especially because the laws in the United States don't protect Native people from violence. There's actually loopholes in several of the laws that allow non-Native people to commit violence against Native people on Native land and not be prosecuted. So we know that it's a very vulnerable population. And I think that there were women who were doing work in our own tribes here in this area who were like, well, what do we do? Because we don't want our young women to go into this world and to feel like they don't know what to do. Yeah. And we have to have different kinds of conversations, and we need to do something to empower. But they weren't just talking about empowering young women. A lot of them were saying, we need to teach our young men that they don't get to think of women the right way that they're told by this culture and society
really
to think of women, right?
That's the starting point, right? I mean, with the men too, is that if you change how they see women, then women don't have to protect themselves all the time.
So it's right? Like we have to also show them, like, how do we show young men and where did that come from? And the more they talk to each other, the more they were like, well, that came from this women's dance, because the young men have to be there. And what my mom says in the book is, you cannot think of a woman as an object once you've danced and sung over her, once you've watched her come out, once you've seen her sing her song for the first time, once you've seen her run and you've watched people like cry because she's becoming a whole woman at that point. You cannot, as a young man, look at that young woman later and think of her only as an object, because you danced and sung over her, you brought firewood for her, you ate with her. So now we're teaching you that she is somebody. And so then you go out into the world and you are like, okay, she's somebody. Now I have to remember she's somebody. She's not just like an object of consumption. She's not something there for me to depersonalize. There's a real concentration in the dance about like sharing and talking, and the young girl being able to ask any question that she wants to, like in her talking circles. There's a discussion even about domestic violence and about violence in relationships in this dance. So I always tell people, like, this is not a story that we included now. It's not like a contemporary thing. It helps now, but this is part of the dance. Like, forever and all time, they were like, at a point, you have to have a conversation with this young woman about violence in relationships. And you got to let her ask all her questions. And I thought, we started doing that with our young people traditionally at like 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. We were like, we have to have this conversation starting now, because we don't want this to be something that you don't understand, or that you feel secretive about, or that you don't have anybody to go to for. If you look at the messages that 11 and 12 year olds are getting from television and movies, it's always about like a vampire that stalks you and treats you badly and then yell, you know what I mean? Like, and then you cry all the time. And then, like, it's about a beast that kidnaps your father and then holds him hostage. And then you go to get him. And then he's really mean to you. And the message is, if you're nice enough, he'll turn into a beautiful, handsome prince. Like, that's the, like, internalized message versus our message that we give a girl at 11 and 12, which is trying to say, how are you going to, like, get strength from this? What are you going to do? How can we help you? And this is about her and her independence, not about all these other things. So, and people ask me all the time, they're like, well, what can I do, right? It's so simple. All you have to do is sit with somebody and tell them stories about puberty and adolescence. Like, yeah, positive stories. And then that's it. That's all. And even if they act like they're not listening to you, they say that that makes all the difference. Like, that's all you have to do.
Well, and but you have to reframe your own personal stories about puberty and adolescence in a positive way, too, right?
Oh, it's true. I mean, like, well, see, here's the thing. So a lot of the reason why I did this research myself, I always say, like, research finds you. And it says, like, this is what you're going to do now. And so what happened was, like, I started my period when I was 12. And my mom.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, my mom, she was like, we're going to go out to dinner. We're going to celebrate. And I was, of course, why would we celebrate, right? I didn't understand. But we went out to the Eureka Inn because that was a fancy restaurant. The waiter came over. His name was Gary. And the reason I know that his name was Gary is because he said, my name is Gary. Are we celebrating anything today? And I looked at my mom like,
please don't.
Please. Like, I was like, don't you dare. And she said, no, we're just like a mother and a daughter out for dinner. And after he left, she said to me, and I was 12 years old, she said, you know, we used to do a dance for girls when they started menstruating. And it was a time of great celebration. And we haven't done this dance in a really long time. But if you wanted me to, I would figure out some way to do it. I would find some way to make it happen. And I didn't know. I didn't know all the reasons why we weren't doing it. I didn't know about colonization. I didn't know about, like, the violence that it took to stop us from doing this dance. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was that she wanted me to, like, in my mind, get up in front of a group of people and, like, announce that I was menstruating. And so I was like, no, I would never do that. That's disgusting. That's so gross. And she let it go. And then for like a number of years after that, she along with other people would have these conversations with each other about what it would mean to bring this dance back. She told her own story to me about how when she started her period, the school told her she was sick and sent her home, but didn't tell her what she was sick with. So in her mind, she's like dying. Like,
well, yes, you're
and,
bleeding.
Yeah, so they're like, you're sick, go home.
But when she got really home, serious.
Her grandfather was there and she was like, you know, I'm sick. So I had to come home. And he was like, you're not sick. Like, you're a woman. This is amazing. And she said he was a guy who wasn't even like a big, he wasn't really into celebrating culture at that time, that she had never thought of him that way. But immediately he was like, this is a big deal. And he said he said to her, he made her sit in a chair and he was like, I don't have a song because we would sing for you. But I don't have a flower dance song, but I have this one song. And he sang to her this song that my whole family sings to babies when they try to put them to sleep. And we call it the Hey Nunny song. And then he made her brothers go to the store and buy her tampons because in his mind, he needed to find some way that they could give her something, wow, like a gift to be involved.
Oh my
so
gosh.
She was like, all that happened. And at the time, I didn't really get what he was doing. I'd never seen one. But in his mind, this is what we do. And he needed to give me that experience of being positive about what was happening to me. And so all the women I talk to, they start talking to each other. Like, they all had moments where somebody said to them, no, this is what it's going to be. And then she had said to me and I had said no. So she worked for a number of years after that with different people in our area on bringing this dance back. And they decided that they were going to do it for the first young woman who had agreed to do it, whose name at the time was Kayla Carpenter. Now she's Kayla Begay. And so they were putting that dance together. And I was living in San Diego at the time. I was in my 20s, and I was actually in a very violent relationship, and I wasn't talking to anybody about it. I didn't tell anybody what was going on, and I always tell people, like, when I think back to my life then, I don't recognize myself in that space. I sort of really, like, if anybody's going through it, like, I lost myself in that relationship. And I couldn't admit what was happening. And one night, after a very sort of, like, loud and dangerous kind of, like, fight, I was on the bathroom floor. So he, like, left me there. And I picked up the phone and I called my mom and I said, "Mom, I'm going to leave him." And she said, "You are making the right decision." And I said, "No, Mom, he's right. I'm nothing. And I'll be nothing without him." And she, like, paused for this really long time on the phone, and I'll never forget it. She said, "Katja, we should have danced for you." And it was for her, she said, at that time, like, this clicking moment of what it would have meant for me not to be able to walk into the world and ever think that I was nothing, that I was nobody. That nobody could tell me that I had to go into the world knowing who I was, so that when somebody would come in and try to tell me that I was nobody, I would be like, that's not a thing, that doesn't exist. And here I was all by myself, and that's where I was at. I felt like nothing. And so I remember I was sitting there and I thought, well, I have to get up the bathroom floor. And I didn't know how I was going to get up. I didn't know how I was going to leave. So I remembered my grandma said to me, like, if you don't know what to do, like, sing a song and then you'll just be able to do what you're supposed to do. And I didn't have a song, but I did have songs that I had heard other people sing. And so I started to sing those songs, and I got up and I, like, packed a bag and I was leaving. And I don't like people to think that it was that simple, because I always say to people, I've done a lot of work with domestic violence and a lot of domestic violence survivors. It's never easy. You go back. I went back, like, you know, all these other things had to happen, but I'll never forget that moment, because that's what I went back to a lot when I was thinking about how I was finally going to get out of this relationship, was that moment of my mom saying to me, like, you are somebody, like, we should have danced for you to show you who you are. And I think that in that moment, my wanting to tell that story, like, to tell this story of this dance and why it's so important, came out of wanting other people, other girls, to be able to see why it's so important and to be able to talk about it, and for those words to be our words, reflecting on why that's so important. And I know that it's helpful. I know that all the young women who we have done this dance for are amazing, and in all different kinds of ways. And Kayla, who I mentioned is the first flower dance girl, is now a professor here at Humboldt State. And all the girls, like, you know, we have one who's a really fantastic, like, educator, one who's finishing law school, one who is, like, at UC Davis studying to be a vet. Like, I mean, just all of them are so powerful in so many ways. And I think that even us as the women of that community who have come in and sang and danced, we have become more powerful because of it. And the men who have come to sing and dance have become more powerful because of it. So our whole community has been able to remember that the empowerment of women empowers the entire community. And that's, I think, really important.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Claire Reynolds, and I've been speaking with Dr. Katja Risling-Baldy about her new book, We Are Dancing for You, Native Feminisms and the Revitalization of Women's Coming-of-Age Ceremonies. For more information, go to katjarislingbaldy.com. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. You can listen to this show again anytime at Through the Eyes of Women blog at khsuwomen.com. Join us again at 1:30 next Monday here on KHSU.